The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 18.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Today my guest is going to be Warren Mosler, who is one of the leading proponents of MMT, or modern monetary theory. The reason I thought it important to cover this issue is MMT has been picking up steam. Stephanie Kelton is an economist who was involved with Bernie Sanders and then now is being cited often by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is being quoted in Bloomberg and things like that. And on Twitter, she's gaining a following, pushing the insights of MMT and showing how the modern policy disputes over government financing and, gee, how are we going to pay for the Green New Deal, or how are we going to pay for Medicare for all? According to Kelton, that's just silly. That's old school gold standard thinking, and these people need to learn how the modern monetary system works. So I thought, you know, now's a good time. Why don't I bring Warren Mosler on? As some of you who have been longtime followers of me know, I debated Warren Mosler in New York City way back on June 6th, 2013. John Carney of CNBC was the host of that. So, of course, I'll link to that debate in the show notes page. This is BobMurphyShow.com/18. Let me just say, I have some regrets about this debate. The one thing for sure is in the opening remarks, I lost track of time. Just so you know, I'm just being honest with you, folks. I had my cell phone because, in other words, there was no clock where I could look at the time. And so I was using my cell phone and I didn't, at the time, tweak the settings so that, you know, as I had the countdown going, the phone went dark on me. And so I, you know, just glancing over, I didn't know how much time I had left. And so I kind of didn't leave myself enough at the end to round up my point. So that was my only real major regret there. Other than that, I'll just say, if you go and watch the debate, and I did have somebody email me this, so I'm not just making this up. The person said something, I'm paraphrasing, but this is definitely the spirit of the email. I said, Bob, I watched your debate against Warren Mosler and MMT, and I have to say, through the first hour and a half, I was getting really upset with you. I could not believe all of the things you were letting Mosler get away with and all the non sequitur and this and that. And then when I saw your concluding remarks, I realized, oh, there was a method to your madness all along, and you were just laying a trap for him. That was great stuff. Unfortunately, he's one of the few people who had that reaction. A lot of people were like, oh, I don't get what Murphy was doing. So, again, like I said, the thing I regret is the opening debate. I think I didn't I didn't use my time properly. But other than that, I'm happy with the points I made. And I understand that people who go into it thinking MMT is right are going to say, yeah, of course it's right. And Murphy didn't dispute anything. But I'll just say that in case you're watching it and wondering what I'm doing. There's a method to my strategy in that debate. What I'm doing now in this conversation here in episode 18 of the Bob Murphy Show is, let me be clear, I am not debating Warren Mosler in this podcast episode. I just want to have a conversation with him and make sure I understand how he thinks about MMT. And so that's what the function of this is going to be. So if you're waiting, you know, getting your popcorn out and ready for there to be a slugfest between two titans here, that's not what you're going to get. So I don't want you to be disappointed. What I am going to do, though, like I say, is push back and try to make Warren clarify some things. But my point here is not to argue with him. I just want to make sure everybody understands what his position is, because, again, he is a leading, if not the leading, world authority on MMT. So as far as his formal bio, let me just say Warren Mosler is an American economist and theorist and one of the leading voices in the field of modern monetary theory, or MMT. Presently, Warren resides on St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he owns and operates Valence Company Incorporated. An entrepreneur and financial professional, Warren Mosler has spent the past 40 years gaining an insider's knowledge of monetary operations. He co-founded AVM, a broker-dealer providing advanced financial services to large institutional accounts, and the Illinois Income Investors family of investment funds in 1982. He began his career after graduating from the University of Connecticut with a BA in economics in 1971 and has been deeply involved in the academic community. So I would say the single most important thing for you to read if you want to get up to speed on Warren's views is his book, The Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy, which, of course, I'll link to at bobmurphyshow.com/18. And he and I are going to get into two or three of the so-called deadly innocent frauds in our discussion. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Warren Mosler. Well, hi, Warren. Thanks for joining us here on episode 18 of The Bob Murphy Show.
Hi, good to be back.
So the audience, I've already prepped them a little bit in the formal introduction here that I gave Warren. But since we are going to end up talking a lot about MMT, can you just give us the abbreviated version of your career trajectory? And, you know, how is it that, you know, you have so much knowledge in these areas? And how is it that you're one of the leading figures in the MMT movement?
Okay, so I happen to, let's say, grow up in the midst of monetary operations. I started in 1973 at a small savings bank, and I was collecting delinquent loans in the loan department. And then there was some reshuffling at the bank. People were promoted, and I wound up handling the investments, which were all of $10 million, $5 million in stock, which we did nothing, and $5 million in just liquidity. And that was my job. In the course of that, I made contacts with people on the other side of the phone who were salespeople trying to get me to do business with them, to buy my CDs and buy my bonds and things, for me to buy bonds from them and buy CDs from them and that type of thing. And that's how I made my first contacts with Wall Street types. One of them was, I was covered by salesmen from Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers and Bankers Trust and variety of others. And that's how I got started looking at the whole field of finance. And from the bank, one of them hired me to work for him at Bation Company in Hartford, Connecticut in 1976. That was George Weiss, who's still around, George Weiss and Associates. And he had me cover what they called their second tier institutions for fixed income. And I spoke to the various institutions around Hartford, Connecticut for fixed income, which included smaller savings banks, but some larger accounts like Travelers and Aetna, people like that. And from there, I got hired. That was 1975. In 1976, I got hired by Jay Pomerantz out of Bankers Trust to go work for him down at 16 Wall Street. They were a primary dealer. And they started me out as a vice president of sales and trading at Ginnie Mae Securities, a government National Mortgage Association debt. And so I moved to New York, and I was there from 1976 to 1978, and that's where I was just immersed in monetary operations. I was in the middle of a money center bank and was direct party to how all the checks cleared, the securities cleared, and when you bought something or sold something, what the debits and credits were, and a lot of it was because of my own inquiry into how things happened, how Fed funds cleared, how things traded. How Fed monetary operations, what they did, what they were, what they did, what the consequences were. And we were always trying to read what the Fed was doing and what the other central banks were doing. And
can I stop you right there? Because I'm curious about that. So were you, it sounds like to me, just you were more curious. In other words, like plenty of your colleagues would be doing the same sorts of day-to-day operations that you were, or tasks. But you wanted to kind of look, am I right in saying that you kind of were curious and wanted to look a little bit deeper and say, but what, you know, what's the big picture? What's actually going on here? And you start asking questions.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in the stories I tell, which I think are in the book, but my memory is not all that great anymore. But, the trading manager, the Fed would raise reserve requirements. And the trading manager was Alan Rogers. And he says, well, I hope the Fed doesn't just give the banks the reserve requirements. The money supply is too high. They should, just make them, cough up the money and not give it to them because we need to bring the money supply down. And I remember saying, they can't do that, Alan. It's just debits and credits. You can't rip a debit or a credit off a balance sheet. There is no such thing. They, a reserve requirement is a requirement. In the first instance, an overdraft, which is a loan. It's just a question of how you price it. It's got nothing to do with adding. I don't know how I actually knew that, but I must have been looking into it enough to know, and by that time, say a year into working there, that's how it worked. And then he says to me, well, there's 300 billion euro dollars sloshing around. They could bring some of those back to the banks and pay for it with those. And I said, you can't do that either. You can't just, you know, rip half of a balance sheet off. It doesn't work that way. You know, if you debit an account, you've got to credit another account. You know, what are you talking about? There is no such thing. So anyway, and the reason I remember this episode is because I got a call from Cliff Viner, who later became my partner. He was at Phoenix Mutual. And he gives me the same story. He was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal by Eric Heinemann, chief economist at Morgan Stanley, saying, I hope the Fed doesn't just give them the money. Same story. And then I explained to Cliff that that's not possible. They have to give him the money. Well, he calls back Morgan Stanley. He was a client of theirs and comes to me with their answer, which was a double talk answer, which we straightened out. He went back to them again and comes back and says they've retracted their statement. They agree the Fed has to head the reserves. So I don't know how I was coming up with this stuff, but I was. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, back in 1977 or something. I was 28 years old, so I wasn't a kid so much. I mean, I was young, but you know, I wasn't 17 or 18 or something like that. And there's just a certain accounting logic that when you understand it, this stuff falls in place and it's not particularly difficult.
Now we're going to, we're certainly going to get into that. And that's going to be the meat of it. But I'm just curious to get your sense of what happened.
Yeah.
In your mind, the things these people were saying that you were like, no, that's not true. Is what they said, would that have been true under the gold standard, but was no longer true? Or do you think that you were just saying no basic accounting things that were true in 1931 as well?
You know, it would have been under a gold standard. It could have caused interest rates to go up, but they still can't just pull this money, you know, off a balance sheet.
Okay.
So,
that's partly why I asked.
We had different ramifications.
Okay. Yeah. Cause some people sometimes, and maybe there's different contexts, but sometimes it's just like described as, oh, that's gold standard thinking, you know, Murphy, and we're talking about modern monetary. And so I'm saying with these particular ones, I was wondering if in your mind it was because they hadn't fully processed what Nixon had done, or if it was just in general, a lot of times people say stuff that's not quite right.
Well, you know, you're right. You know, that's where it came from. And I hadn't thought about that at the time. I wasn't thinking about that. I was just thinking we were working in a bank and I know what they have to do. But yeah, you know, because you know, under the gold standard, your lending is reserve constrained. And so by changing the reserve requirements, it changes your ability to lend, where under floating exchange rate, it doesn't. And so at the time, that's not what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, I was just thinking, look, the Fed's going to do this and they're going to add the reserves because there's no other way to do it. And I didn't have any reason to start thinking whether or not it was gold standard or not. That came later. That came in the 1990s when I started putting those pieces together. It's not that I didn't think of it. I didn't have any reason to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I interrupted you there. Do you want to continue just filling in your autobiographical details?
Yeah. So, and a couple of other things would come up then, you know, they'd say, $2 billion, 2-year notes, which was huge money at the time, you know, who's going to buy those? And I'm there, well, it's the same money they spend that buys the 2-year notes. They spend, they add it to accounts, and then those accounts either buy the bonds, the 2-year notes, or they just sit there as, you know, reserve balances that don't earn anything instead of buying 2-year notes at 8% or whatever they were at the time. We were running a bank, a money desk at the time. I said, hey, there's no reasoning. You know, that's just where the money comes from. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It's just it's a pair off. You know, it's one, they're equal. And nobody seemed to understand that at the time. They just sit there and watch every night the Bank of England, what they bought or what they didn't buy, and we get a list. And what would ever happen if the Bank of England didn't buy the debt? The country would, I don't know. It wasn't Greece you turn into at the time. It was some equivalent of that, right?
Right.
And, you know, then it was Japan and Saudis and now it's China. You know, it's the same stories over and over again, you know. I'm looking at it going, that doesn't make any difference whether they buy the debt or not. It might mean one basis point in the auction or something. It would go to second highest bidder. It just means somebody else has the reserve balances. And your choices are either just sit in reserves, which earn at the time nothing. We didn't pay interest on reserves, or buy the securities, which are just other accounts at the Fed. There's no risk difference. If you hold a reserve account at the Fed or a securities account at the Fed, it's all the same thing. It just didn't make any sense to me to worry about who's going to buy the debt back then. Because it's just circular. And of course, it never did. I remember Reagan saying, oh, if it's ever gets to 90 billion, we're all doomed, right? So anyway, go ahead. Oh, so anyway, from Bankers Trust, one of my clients was William Blair and Company. They never did any business with me, but he listened to the stories and he said, about trades and opportunities. He said, well, why don't you come out here and do this for us? And I said, I already had a pretty good job. I thought I was, you know, vice president of this bank in New York, managing the bank. He said, well, we don't pay a salary. We'll just give you a retail payout. We'll give you 30% of whatever profits you can make. And it's not quite this extreme, but the story I say is, you know, that was on a Wednesday, and I started there the next Monday when I heard that. But I immediately went out, you know, interviewed, and it was very shortly thereafter that I went out to do that. And they were a relatively small broker dealer. They had 7 million in capital, I think, but we did extremely well and wound up making a lot of money for myself and William Blair and all the other partners. And it was a very, very, very good relationship. Ned Giannotto was the head of the firm, and he was, you know, just a fantastic human being and person to work for and work with. And it was a very, very strong partnership. And we did very well. And then after several years, we had the ability to do the same kind of trading with arbitrage. We did fixed income arbitrage with more capital. And so we started a new fund called, so I went to Blair in 1978, but 1982 mm-hmm. started a fund called the III, Illinois Income Investors at the time. And it started with 10 million capital, and William Blair was a partner, and we got some local people involved, and then started growing that company. And then I left William Blair physically in 1984, moved Illinois Income Investors to Florida. Blair remained a partner for several years, and till it didn't make sense for them to do that anymore. And then that company I ran for 15 years from 1982 to 1997. When I turned it over to my other partners, I kept, I now have a 10% interest that I've kept, but I turned the majority of it over at the end of 1997 after 15 years. We had over $3 billion in capital, maybe something close to 3.5 back when that was a fair amount of money. And we, for 15 years, you know, I'll just say this. I know it's you're only as good as your next trade, but we didn't have a losing trade for 15 years. We had an alpha, which was a return over the risk-free rate of average 6.5%. The net return to investors was a compounded 14.5%. And we were rated number one for fixed income funds in what was called managed account reports at the time for pretty much the entire time. So it was a good run, and we did very well. And then I started focusing on other things and still made a contribution from other places. So I stopped going into the firm every day and let the others take over. And now I live in the U.S. Virgin Islands and in St. Croix, and I make my 10% contribution from here.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you at this point, would you say that some of that success, was it in part due to the way you looked at financial markets and the edge you had from your knowledge of MMT, or is it kind of orthogonal to your investing acumen?
Yeah, it's just the ability to look at things and see them and maybe in an elemental way, which is what MMT is all about. You know, somebody starts talking to me about something, I say, well, what accounts are you? Don't give me the rhetoric. What are you debiting and what are you crediting? What are you doing here? And a lot of times when you ask that question, they don't have any idea. And when you come right down to it, it's not the way they thought it was. So you have to be able to ground everything in the accounting. Look, the monetary system is just an accounting system. It's a way of keeping track of debits and credits. That's all it is. There's nothing else to it right now. And that it all is expressed that way. It's like a mathematical system is expressed with numbers. You could be adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing. It expresses everything, and you have to be able to tie it back to that. It all has to add up. Your checkbook has to balance, so to speak. And so that's how I looked at a lot of these trades. I remember one trade I was buying interest 15-year mortgages. They were called dwarfs at the time. They were Fannie Mae's or Ginnie Mae dwarfs. I can't remember. And they were yielding 10%, and interest rates were at 5%. Well, you could just buy them and make a 5% spread, but you're taking an enormous risk that the Fed didn't tighten, raise rates. And then, because if rates got above 10, you'd start losing money.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, we didn't take any interest rate risk. So that was way out. It's not the kind of thing we did. So, but at the same time, they had something new out called LIBOR caps, which were insurance policies. And you could say, okay, you could buy a LIBOR cap that was struck at 6%, 7%, 8%. I said, well, how much was a 9%? my workout cost me, which meant that if race went over nine, I'd get paid the difference. So it was an insurance policy that said if race go over nine, we'll make good on all that. Well, how much do I have to pay for that? And they said 6 points for 10 years. Okay, so for roughly, you know, and this is not exact math, but, you know, 6.6%, half a percent a year for 10 years, I could be guaranteed I never have to pay more than 9% to borrow money. And so that meant I was guaranteed not to have to pay more. You know, I have the cost of my cap, which was a 0.5% a year plus the 9%. So anything over 9%, I'm going to get reimbursed for. Over 9.5%, I'm going to get reimbursed for. And the securities were yielding 10. Mm-hmm. So I knew if I bought them at 10% and I bought my 9%, you know, interest rate insurance policy and paid 0.5% a year for it, the worst case, I was going to make 0.5%, roughly. Now, the securities didn't have exact maturities or anything like that, but it was pretty close. And in the meantime, I'm financing them at 5% at the Fed funds rate. And I can finance them for a term, like the first year, which would give me 5 points under my belt, which meant I've gotten my insurance premium back, you know, before I even started. So this looked like a pretty good trade. I called the theory behind this trade that 10 is more than 9, right? Now, that's a pretty simple way of looking at it. And other people weren't looking at it that way. I'd show it to clients and they'd come back with reams of paperwork showing that, well, if the Fed does this and the yield curve does that and this happens and that, you could lose money. There's risk in this trade. I'm thinking, look, I know that 10 is more than 9. This pretty much has to work here, guys. Yeah. So
as you're explaining, I mean, was the only real risk that in case they defaulted on those mortgages?
Well, those they were bonds? Government guaranteed. You know?
Oh, they were government guaranteed? Okay.
I wasn't worried about that. There was no credit risk. You know, they could all pay off the next day or something like that. But they were at discounts and you'd get your money back at par. So you'd have a big profit if that happened. I was hard pressed to find, you know, any problem with these. They're 8% mortgages at a price of 80 or something like that. So, you know, but people did, and I'd have to go back. And these are very sophisticated accounts with people using computers and all that kind of advanced technology, coming up with all these reasons why this wasn't going to work. And, you know, at the end of the day, they'd come around and agree, and we all made a fair amount of money putting this trade on. But nobody else had come up with that. I'm not sure why, and we can talk about it now. Those were the type of things. And I was seeing those things even in the last few years, that same type of thing. And I'll tell you, Bob, after 15 years of doing this without a losing trade, you know, during year 14, I still had these things coming, you know, I was still coming up with these things and we're still putting them on making money. Mm-hmm. People still didn't like them. It wasn't like 14 years track record made any difference to them. They'd look at it and they'd go, no, I don't think that's going to work. Now, we had 4 or 5 clients, maybe half a dozen clients who caught on, and they all did, you know, very well. And those people have gone on and done, you know, a lot of good things since then. You know, the majority of the street and everybody else just had no interest in this stuff.
And not because it wasn't like sexy enough to intrigue them, but because they actually looked at it and thought, nah, you're missing something, even though they couldn't tell you what when you pressed them.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Huh. It's still hard for me to understand some of this pushback on MMT, because it's just, to me, well, we'll get into it. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can you dispute any of this? You know, how can you dispute that you have to credit an account before you debit it? You know, the government spends first and then it collects taxes. How can you dispute that? Everybody in the Fed knows this. You have to do a reserve add before you can do a reserve drain. It's just an accounting mm-hmm. balance. It's just a spreadsheet.
Well,
you know, so you got to put in a credit before you can do debt.
Yeah, so we will definitely get into that imminently, but let me just, so what
you'll see, it'll tie back to the same concepts. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at what point did you, like, when did, first of all, that phrase modern monetary theory, just for, yeah. I guess I'm not actually sure myself, like, where did that come from? Like, you didn't invent that, did you?
Or? Somebody on Bill Mitchell's blog started calling it that 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
And it just stuck. And we didn't have any reason to. It seemed to be, nothing was going anywhere with this thing. And then suddenly when he stuck that name on it, all of a sudden we see it popping up in different places. So he said, all right, you know, you know, we don't particularly like it, but it wasn't anything particularly wrong with it either. So, mm-hmm. you know, let's let it go. And, it's, you know, finally, you know, something's working here. We're getting some notoriety. So we just left it.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people tie it back to, like, I'm a learner and I guess what functional finance and is that how you view it as well? Like, or did you come out on your own and then realize, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole history here. Just, do you have any, you can share with us about that?
Yeah. Everything I did was totally independent. I'd never even read Keynes. I mean, I'd seen quotes from Keynes, but I'd never read them in school. I started off in engineering for 2 years, had economics for 2 years and didn't do much. And, so, no, I didn't know any of that. But what would happen is other people would see what I'm doing, and then they'd go back to see if somebody else had anything like it before. And they're still discovering things. Mm-hmm. You know, as back as 2000 BC, somebody in Samaria said this or something.
Right.
So they're still discovering this. They discovered Lerner. And they had known about some of these people, but had not necessarily looked at it in this context. There's a quote from Adam Smith about the prince who comes up with his own currency, can decide what it's worth or something like that. So there were some ancillary things. A guy named Innes, somebody found this in 1900, wrote something that was very good. I've got it on my website. So after I discovered it, written about it, worked with people about it for several years, some of these academic scholars went back to see where this is, you know, if there had been any of it. Knapp, they found in his state theory of money, and a lot of them had known little bits and pieces about it, had remembered it, or it triggered thoughts, and they went back and found some of this. So yeah, little bits and pieces are all there. So I can't say any one thing is entirely original in that nobody had ever thought of it before, but I can say it was entirely original in that I did think of it, come up with it independently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, just to bring people up to speed, would you say right now, like if someone wants to go, obviously I'm going to point them to your blog and or your website, I should say, and all your readings there.
Yeah.
Somebody who's making a big name now is Stephanie Kalten. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right.
Kalten, yeah. Stephanie Kalten.
Who, and you mentioned Bill Mitchell. Who else, right? Like, who are the leading names when you think of like the, you know, MMT's leading thinkers right now or proponents?
Right. So the proponents would be, you know, Bill Mitchell for sure, Stephanie for sure, Randy Ray, who is now, I don't know what's happened to him, he got married to a woman from China and they had a child, and I haven't heard much from him since. I've got Shane Ray in my office right here. How's your dad doing? He's doing well, but you know, he's I'm not sure what he's doing, but you don't hear from him too much anymore. He had his blog for a while, and geez, I've worked closely with him since 1994 or 5, worked with him you know, to make this whole thing happen. And I have to say, it wouldn't have happened without him. These people have been instrumental in making it get to the point where it is today. Without them, it would not have gotten to the point where it is today, you know, for sure. And, you know, Randy's the one who organized the whole thing at Levy and then at UMKC, and, you know, working with Matt Forstatter, who is an original, and he's coming up with a Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and going to, who knows how many academic conferences and presenting papers for years and years and years. And it's all cumulative, and it's all added up to get us somewhere, looks like past the tipping point, maybe in 2013. And now it's growing, seems to be geometrically with the more recent publicity we've been getting.
So, right. Yeah. And I just, I promise we're going to get
into the senior guys were Bill, Randy, Matt, trying to think of, well, I don't want to leave anybody out. Stephanie they knew her as a grad student at Cambridge. She got her PhD. She came back. They got her to work at UMKC with them. Mm-hmm. Her name was Stephanie Bell at the time. And she tells the story on her YouTube. You can see it about when I said the government spends first and then collect taxes later. She said, no, that doesn't sound right. And Randy says to her, well, go do a paper on it. Go look at the Fed, talk to them. You know, go into all their accounts, and she did, and came back and said, "Well, you know, happens to be true." Mm-hmm. So, and everything was a struggle. Okay, nothing was easy. I went to Australia maybe 10 times to Bill's conferences and events, working with all the people down there, the Reserve Bank down there. I pretty much used the, you know, all of the above approach to just get to as many people as I could, and you know, try, you know, 10, 20 different channels all at the same time and see which ones would eventually turn into something. So that includes visiting with central banks and treasuries all over the world, discussing these things with them and academics, U.S. and all over the world also. So it's been a long journey.
So it seems to me, but tell me if you agree, that in the U.S., the reason, like the most immediate explanation for why all of a sudden is MMT huge is that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was citing it. Do you agree with that, or is that really just okay?
Going back just a little bit, when Stephanie took the position as head of the chief economist of the Senate Budget Committee under Bernie Sanders, that was a big move also, which got things going, which got it to be acceptable enough for this latest generation to pick it up. Without that, I don't think it would have gotten to them. But yes, this has been a big leap forward from where it was under Sanders, but it's kind of on the shoulders of the previous step, I think.
Right, okay.
But who knows? Who knows?
Right. Okay, last like sort of fun tidbit before we dive into the the MMT content.
Yeah.
You also, I was doing research on you before this interview, and you formed an automotive line and the several cars you were involved in designing. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So I started off with I'm by nature in my own way very competitive. And I'm looking at the way cars are being built and things are happening in the 1980s. And I learned a little bit about composites and how they were made. And I said, I can build a car light enough so that it can outrun any car on the road and get 30 miles a gallon. And if I could do that, everybody would want to buy it. And it would be this huge marketing success. So I wound up building this car, the Consolator GTP. It weighed 2,000 pounds when Corvettes and Porsches weighed 3,400 pounds. And with only 175 horsepower, it ran rings around all of them. And it got 30 miles a gallon when everybody else was getting 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted it. So I was wrong. I was right on 2 out of 3. And then that got a company called Unigraphics came down and had a design they wanted because they liked the way my car performed. But they thought the problem was the looks of the car. They could make a better looking car. So I wound up working with their designer and came up with the Mosler MT900 in the year 2000. Same thing. The first one weighed 2,000 pounds. It was the MT900, 900 kilograms. We took it to Daytona for the 24-hour race with a stock engine in it, and it ran rings around everybody, qualified on the pole. And it looked way better. Everybody liked it, but we still never did sell any. I mean, maybe sold 50 or 60 cars in 4 or 5 years. And they're still winning races 18 years on, and it got 30 miles a gallon again. And so...
that is an attractive-looking vehicle. I'll link to it, folks.
Yeah, people like
BobMurphyShow.com /18. But yeah, it's an attractive vehicle.
Yeah. And so, but still didn't sell. And so it's in that. I called it a disease, my car disease. And I sold that company in 2013 for scrap value. And I haven't, and then I started looking at boats because I was down here in St. Croix and it's one of those islands that's completely surrounded by water. Boats are the thing. I'm looking at how boats are ride and making everybody seasick. And I start riding on these boats and I realize it's the same thing as a car. It's a long wheelbase versus a short wheelbase or zero wheelbase question. I built this ferry, which you can see at QE4ferry.com. And it's got, wheels way out front, wheels in the back with a big space in the middle where it doesn't touch the water, but they're not wheels. They're hulls, of course. In the water, you drag, you don't roll. And it's built this ferry, and it's been taking people for 2 years back and forth through St. Thomas, and everybody loves it. And it's just totally revolutionized surface transportation. You don't get the pitching that causes people to get seasick. Every once in a while, people will get sick from 6 or 8 foot waves, but it's not, they'll throw up from being jarred around, but it's not the seasick thing where they're on the floor and they can't, they're out for a day. And it's usually because they ate huge breakfast before they get on the boat, but it's, let's say, at least 90% reduced, and that's been fun, and it's been very successful. People used to get off the other ferries and just lay down in the dock and say, "I'm never going to do this again," and then it didn't take very many people. This one's been doing very well, and people get off and they love it, and they're riding it continuously all the time. So that's been good.
And so the website with that was, you said QE4ferry.com.
QE4ferry.com.
Now, is that a play on quantitative easing or is that just something else?
Yeah. So it was sort of a play on that. It's also you know, play on being an ocean liner. It's going back and forth across the ocean. It's got four hulls in the water, so it's QE4. And it was also kind of a stab at quantitative easing, yeah.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, yeah, I just want to let people know that you had – because, yeah, you're the Wikipedia, I looked up the MT-900 just to see, and we haven't – I think it came in second at least in one – some major competition.
Yeah, well, that was in Daytona, maybe 19 – in 2002 or three, and then they kicked us out. The Consoleers won races, and they were kicked out too. All my cars have all been, and the MT-900 was kicked out of international racing in Europe. It can run in the national racing, British GT, Spanish GT. And last year, I think two of them won the Spanish GT series, the whole series. So that's a car that's 18 years old, running against fourth generation Porsches and Ferraris and Aston Martins, maybe fifth generation. And they still have to add ballast and put restrictors on the engine or they don't let it run. So it's still competitive.
That fascinates me. Did they give you some kind of reason? Like, did they say this doesn't count because of such and such?
No, they just want it in there. And, you know, companies like Porsche would make a statement. If you let this car run, we're not going to enter. But racing is somewhat theater where these people, they don't think they have a chance of winning. They're not going to be in there. And so the organizers fix things so they can win, you know, and they kind of rotate year to year.
And I guess Porsche has more pull than you do. That's
apparently.
Okay. Let's take a break from my conversation with Morin Mosler. Well, folks, as I mentioned in the intro to this episode, my point here is not to debate Warren. I just want to make sure we understand his worldview. If you do want to see me push back against a lot of the ideas he's bringing up, particularly the idea of using the printing press to finance government spending, then I would point you to my books in the Politically Incorrect Guide series, namely my Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and New Deal. To see more about these books and how you can order them, go to bobmurphyshow.com/pig. That's bobmurphyshow.com/PIG. All right, well, let's, get to your main book here is called The Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy.
Yeah.
So can you maybe just spend a moment talking about the title? And I know the backstory, but just for the listeners, why do you call it innocent frauds? What's the story behind that phrase?
Well, it was started by John Kenneth Galbraith, who I like. So it was kind of a hat tip towards him. And he had a book called, something about innocent frauds, which I read. It was his last book. It was very short. And I like the term.
Yeah, I think it's the economics of innocent fraud.
Economics of innocent fraud, yeah. And, you know, not that I agree with everything, but I always admire the way he writes, his ability to write. I wish I had that ability to write. I'm just more straightforward. But anyway, so the thing about innocent fraud is you're giving him two choices. Either it's fraud or it's stupidity, and they don't understand it. And it's hard to say which one is worse, right? It's not conceding anything.
Yeah. That's the thing is that on one level, someone might look at that and say, oh, that's nice. Mosler is not attributing malice to his opponents. But as you explained in your introduction, this is actually almost a backhanded compliment that you're, you know, saying that these people are too witless to even get what they're doing.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Well, I think maybe the best way to motivate this is, how about I just quickly read the fraud, you know, the seven frauds out. So again, and then you and I can obviously dive into it. So folks, these are things that Warren Mosler is saying are incorrect statements that unfortunately too many policymakers in the public believe. So I'll just blow through these really fast. Number one, the government must raise funds through taxation or borrowing in order to spend. In other words, government spending is limited by its ability to tax or borrow. Number two, with government deficits, we are leaving our debt burden to our children. Three, government budget deficits take away savings. Four, Social Security is broken. Five, the trade deficit is an unsustainable imbalance that takes away jobs and output. Six, we need savings to provide the funds for investment. And seven, it's a bad thing that higher deficits today mean higher taxes tomorrow. Okay, so those are the seven frauds, and that you're spending your book, you sort of explain the theory behind why they're wrong, like just to show factually in your mind that they're incorrect.
Yeah.
And then you also interweave your sort of, you know, personal history and the relevance. And then you end the book with a section on, you know, so what? So what do we do? You know, how does this affect the future?
What are our policy options?
Right. Okay. So if I think probably the best way for us to use our time remaining here is number one seems like a big one. So let's just reread that. Yeah. The government must raise funds through taxation or borrowing in order to spend. In other words, government spending is limited by its ability to tax or borrow. And I think here, the way I've seen this motivated a lot, like with Stephanie Calton and others, is objecting to when people talk about some program like Medicare for All or Social Security and say, hey, how are we going to pay for this? And that, that just, you know, the fingers on the chalkboard to MMT people. Yeah. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah. You know, and they don't say it the way I do.
Okay.
And that's what gets them in trouble a lot of times. They're not that they're wrong, but they're saying things that have an ambiguity in them. For example, they'll say taxes don't fund spending. Well, what does the word fund mean? Okay. So what I say is like spending is not constrained by revenues.
Can I stop you for a second? When you say they don't say, you mean even other MMT advocates? You're saying think MMT they should?
Yeah, I think are responsible. Not that they're not doing a phenomenal job. Look where we are. But everything the way I see it is a lot of these questions have come about because of some of the terms some of the language they're using.
I got you. Okay.
So if you say taxes don't fund spending. Well, I'm not saying that's wrong, but it depends on the definition of what fund means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when the government spends, so let's look at the question of how are you going to pay for it? And my answer is the Treasury instructs the Fed to credit the appropriate account. Now, you might not know what that means. So you ask me, what does that mean? Well, somebody at the Treasury sends an email or calls somebody at the Fed or sends them instructions, gives them instructions to change the number in the account of whoever's getting the money from a lower number to a higher number. So if the Treasury is paying you $5,000 and you have an account at JP Morgan, the Treasury will call the Fed and say, change the number in JP Morgan's account at the Fed from, you know, $50 million to $50,005,000. And the Fed changes the number, and that's how the government pays for things. Now, there's no dispute about that. That's what they do. And the guy at the Fed who does that doesn't, you know, first call the guy at the Treasury and say, bring over a bag of money so I can do this. And he doesn't take a gold coin and a hammer and somehow put it into his computer. He just changes a number from a low number to a higher number. When Bernanke was asked about how the Fed spends, he says, we use the computer to mark up the number in someone's account. Mm-hmm. It's not like, there's no dispute about this. It's just data entry. It's a change. The same way if you kick a field goal and your score is 7 points and then the stadium gives you 3 points, they just change the 7 into a 10. That's the process of
right.
Spending.
It's not that just yeah. It's not that the ref. It's not that the scorekeepers have a big stockpile and that just went down by three. Right. You're saying
right, and that's okay. Not like there's nothing to dispute about that. That's not shouldn't be controversial or anything. That's just how it's done. Now, that doesn't mean you don't need taxes. It doesn't mean anything. It just means this is how it's done. This is how it's paid for. So now, you say to the person, "Do you have a follow-up question, or does that answer your question of how you're going to pay for it?" Right. So go ahead. I'll let you.
Okay. Yeah. So, let me just say, Warren, I know there are some listeners that are going to want me to pounce and say, no, actually the Treasury and the Fed are independent entities. To me, that's not, you know, I'm willing to stipulate for the sake of argument.
But the Treasury still gives the Fed instructions to do that, whether you think they're independent or not.
Okay. Yeah, sure. But I'm just saying, I don't, so if the Fed to me, says that's not the important thing
where I disagree. Says no. Again. If the Fed doesn't do it, then the government's not spending. I agree.
Yeah. that's a good way.
If Greece goes to the European Central Bank and says, credit the account of the IMF to $500 million to pay off my debt, and the ECB does it, they just credit the account, then the IMF's paid. That money doesn't come from anywhere. If the ECB says no, no way, then they're not paid and they got a big problem. But that's how spending takes place. Somebody gives the bank instructions to credit an account. It's not like this is pile of money somewhere. The central bank doesn't have any dollars. The Fed doesn't have any dollars. They don't not have any dollars. All they do is change numbers and accounts. Mm-hmm. Just like if we're in a card game and you get 10 points and I'm the scorekeeper. I don't have any points. I just mark your account up or I mark it down. It's all it is. It's the Federal Reserve is the scorekeeper, and I'll say for the government. If you want to argue they're not working for the government, that's a different argument. But they're the scorekeeper.
Okay. Like I say, I'm just going to clarify for the listeners that I'll stipulate for the sake of argument, we can think of the Fed and the federal government as a unified accounting entity, let's say.
Right. And they follow the instructions of Congress under the Federal Reserve Act, or else I guess they get arrested or something. I don't know what happens if they Same thing, like if the military decides to invade a country without Congress, I don't know what happens. The Fed's the same thing. There's a Federal Reserve Act which specifies what they can do. And Chairman Bernanke said, look, I take my marching orders from Congress. Mm-hmm. Right there in the Federal Reserve Act. And he used to go to them to ask permission to make different monetary operations that weren't in the Federal Reserve Act. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, that's a separate argument.
Okay. So here, let's just make this tangible.
Yeah.
So somebody says, you know, hey, I'd love the idea of Medicare for all.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now, we're already running huge budget deficits and we can't raise taxes anymore. The public would revolt. So sorry, we just can't afford it.
Yeah.
And so now what you as the proponent of MMT, are you like just going to quibble about, well, technically, or do you think, no, that's really, you're looking at the world the wrong way and there's something huge you're overlooking?
Yeah. So I'll say, look, it's not about the money. It's about, do we have the purpose of taxes and tax liabilities is to cause things to be for sale. Is all this stuff for sale? Can it be purchased for U.S. dollars, let's say at current prices, or not? You know, what's our analysis on what it's going to do overall? So here's how I look at it, and I might be wrong, it might be too superficial, but the methodology is what we're talking about here. So I say, look, the private sector is spending, or the total cost for healthcare are three, and I'll use very round numbers, sure. I know they've changed, $3 trillion. And out of that, the private sector is spending, let's say $1 trillion for very round numbers, and maybe it's only $500 billion, I don't know what it is administrative charges. And these administrative charges under Medicare for All, these administrative responsibilities, duties, things, which includes advertising and marketing and paperwork and trying to sell people this stuff, is, you know, employs 5 million people. Okay. So, if we go to Medicare for All, the government's just going to expand Medicare, for drop it to age zero, and the administrative charges, costs, hiring these, we've got firms that administer Medicare, is going to go up some, but not anywhere near that amount. We're going to lose 5 million jobs. Okay, so unemployment's going to go up by 5 million. And so what we have here is a deflationary event. We've got corporations who are no longer going to be paying their healthcare costs. Their costs are going to drop dramatically. A lot of them are in competitive businesses where they're striving for market share. So their costs are going to go down, and that's a deflationary event. Okay. Now, at the same time, their income is going to be higher because they don't have to pay for this. And to some extent, they're going to spend that money. But to another extent, when corporations save all this money, a lot of times they just add it to capital. It's kind of zero multiple stuff. We don't know how much effect that's going to have. Individuals paying for their health care no longer have to pay for it. It's going to increase their spending by how much, we don't know. But what we know in the first instance is costs have come down. 5 million people are going to be out of work. That is not the kind of situation where you want to raise taxes or cut spending to pay for it. If anything, you better be standing by to go the other way, to either lower taxes or increase public spending to offset this initial massive deflationary shock to the system, as the entire system in real terms is saving 5 million jobs. Okay, jobs are costs, not benefits. And we don't need them anymore. This is an efficiency thing. This is like going from cutting the lawn with scissors to cutting it with lawnmowers. And yeah, there's going to be people out of work, but we want to have the private sector strong enough. We need enough demand, enough people looking to buy things. So now they're going to expand and hire all these people who are now out of work to produce real output. We want to transition these people into other private sector jobs, you know, in an orderly fashion. And so it's not intuitively obvious that we would need to raise taxes by $1 trillion if we go Medicare for All. It's what's more intuitively concerning is that we're going to have to go the other way because of what we've done to the economy. It's a massive productivity shock. Positive productivity shock to the economy. Okay, so that's how I look at it. You can, and I'd say understanding the monetary system allows you to look at it from that way rather than just, does the government have the money or not?
Okay, I do disagree with you on that, but let's put, maybe Medicare is confusing. Let's say something like, hey, let's go put a base on Mars. And someone says that's going to cost $5 trillion over the next 10 years to do that.
Yeah.
Sorry, it sounds like a great program. We just don't have the money right now. Look at, you know, taxpayers are stretched thin. We're clearly, you know, running $1 trillion.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, as an MMT person, suppose you heard me say that. Yeah, we just don't have the money to fund a Martian project right now.
I say, all right, how much are you talking about in rocket fuel? How many scientists and engineers do we need? You know, what are these people doing now? If they're all doing medical research and we're going to have to shift them to the space program, then we're not going to be curing cancer. Or if they're all growing food, we're not going to have enough to eat. Or if they're all going to be building automobiles, we're not going to have enough cars. Are these people, you know, okay, so let's look at the choices we have is how to allocate the resources we have, which is number one, the population. How do we want that allocated? Number one, how many people do we want in the public sector and how many in the private sector? The public sector is removing people from the private sector. Okay, they have to come from somewhere. And without the public sector, they're all in the private sector. When we start provisioning the public sector, we're removing people from the private sector. And so does it serve public purpose? Does it help the private sector if we remove this many people? So if we remove people to build the Panama Canal, for example, does that help the private sector? Well, they're going to lose all these individuals to down there digging this Panama Canal, but the savings through trade and the benefits and the efficiency gains and the productivity gain more than offsets it. So yes, that's a good decision. No, it's just a big mud hole. We're never going to use it. It's going to flop. All we're doing is losing real private sector output. So it's a bad decision. Can I give you a real good example here, Bob?
Sure.
I was sitting with a guy in 1999 or 2000 from the Pentagon. And he said, we really need to increase the military. I said, okay, fine. But right now we just had unemployment at 3.8%. You start building the military now, you're going to be taking people out of the private sectors. Capacity utilization was at a low level. You know, all the steel was going into private sector uses. We were building buildings. We had that whole dot-com boom, remember? And in 1999, I said, you know, there's not a lot of excess capacity now to start building the military. I said, you should have done this, you know, 8 years ago in the recession when we had excess capacity. And steel, and we had, you know, 10, you know, I don't know how many million people unemployed. That would have been the time to build the military when we had this excess capacity. But, you know, now it's going to be problematic. It's probably going to be highly inflationary to do that because you're going to have to pay higher and higher prices to dislodge people who are already doing something productive in the private sector. And he says, well, yeah, but, you know, back then we couldn't afford it because we were running a deficit. Today we're running a surplus, so we have the money to do it, right? So that tells you everything that's wrong with the way we're making decisions today and how, understanding the monetary system, we would never think that way. We'd make more rational decisions as to when to provision the private sector and by how much. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's great. So, and I think you kind of tied into the elements I wanted to bring up. So yeah. You'll see a lot of MMT proponents sort of, you know, getting exasperated with their critics. And they'll say, we're not saying there's, you know, that their government can just spend whatever it wants without limit. And we have, you know, a prosperity pump. The ultimate constraint would be inflation. But we're just saying, you know, that Uncle Sam never needs to default on treasuries. Like, we always can just print money to pay off bonds. So the narrow, you know, bean counters in terms of the, you know, in other words, it's not like the U.S. government is a big corporation. That's the wrong model to use. But yes, there are physical constraints, natural constraints, and what would ultimately happen is inflation would rise if aggregate demand were too high. And so it sounds like you're agreeing with that.
That's interesting because, you know, have we ever seen inflation from excess aggregate demand? Yes, it's possible. And I could do it if you asked me to. I know I could do it. But if you look back at the different inflations, we always had reasonably low aggregate demand. If you look at Turkey today, they don't have, you know, they got 10% or something headline unemployment. Who knows what the real unemployment is? And they got 25% inflation. It's hard to say that's coming from aggregate demand, right? So there are a lot of sources of what we call inflation, which is some CPI index going up, you know, other than aggregate demand. And we're likely to get inflation from something else. I'd say a lot more likely than we are from aggregate demand. We got inflation from the oil shock back in the 70s. The price of oil goes from 3 to 40 over 10 years, and everything else gets pushed up through the, you know, cost plus channel, right? That wasn't from aggregate demand. That wasn't from overspending. You know, that's a whole different, that was a foreign monopolist setting the price of oil, right? And so it's interesting the way we all focus on this inflation coming from excess aggregate demand when it's pretty hard to find an example of when that happened. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's not easy. And these other massive causes of inflation that happen, like, you know, Venezuela, you look at the corruption down there and some guy was arrested for $1.2 billion banking fraud, where they borrowed, you know, they were loaned money to insiders and take it to Miami and sell it for dollars and buy stuff in the States to launder money, and drives the FX rate down, which exchange rate down, so imported prices go up, so the government starts paying more and everything's indexed, right? It's not, it's got nothing to do with aggregate demand. It's just got this massive corruption stuff that happens. So, yes, we have to be wary of excess demand causing inflation. But I'll just say it's. I think there's quite a ways to go before you get that. And when you do, it doesn't just turn into hyperinflation on day one. It goes 3%, 5%. There are plenty of places that have lingered with 5 or 6% inflation for a long time, which comes to, can I say a word about inflation and MMT?
Sure.
This is probably our most important insight, and the MMT proponents don't seem to go there because I think they're weary of confusing people or something, but it's a fundamental. Okay, what I'm talking about is that the currency itself is a case of monopoly. And everybody knows how monopolies work, right? And the way it works is that the government is the only supplier of the dollars that can be used to pay taxes. I mean the government and its agents. And right now the commercial banks are agents of the government through the Federal Reserve Act, and the dollars to pay taxes can come only from the government or its agents, the commercial banks. And they're controlled on how much they can do this by the Federal Reserve Act and the government. Okay. And I'm not saying that the lobbyists from the banks don't control the government. There's feedback loops. I know all that. Okay. But the money to pay taxes comes from the state. And that means it's price setter, whether it likes it or not, and whether it knows it or not. And that means that as a simple point of logic, the price level is a function of prices paid by the government when it spends, period. And there's no way around that. And that's demonstrated over and over again. All the data shows it, and every measure of the price level that there's ever been, you know, since the beginning of time. And not just with money, but with any case of monopoly. And so that is the source of the price level. And that is the source of inflation. It's ultimately the government paying more for the same thing. Otherwise, you just have a relative value shift, and it will come back to the government's prices. So, and it is just because it's people can't understand it, or just because it sounds far-fetched or something, doesn't mean it's not the case. And you talk to this with Treasury people and central bankers, and they agree completely. But for some reason, you know, it's not easy to talk to the guy next door about it that way. And so it's not happening. And it's an important element that hasn't been out there to nail everything down.
Okay, and I do want to come back to that. But yeah. if we can just try to close the loop on this first one. Okay. So let me say something and you tell me if this is true or not.
Yeah.
So over like a 30-year horizon, let's say, going forward, the difference between having the current mindset in place versus somebody who's totally on board with, you know, the Warren Mosler view, it sounds like you're saying the only real major difference would be that in those periods where there was high unemployment and capacity underutilization, that's where the difference would manifest itself, where you're mentality would allow for the government not to worry about these arbitrary, you know, budget rules and whatnot, and would be able to employ those resources.
Yeah.
But over the 30-year, I mean, it would only be in those brief pockets where under the status quo, there would be high unemployment and underutilization. When there's full employment, it just would be, I mean, possibly the output mix would be different, but it's not that the society would be richer per se. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, you're richer if you can use your excess capacity, but you're and everything's path dependent. So in that sense, you're richer in the long term, right? If we had run 5% hotter the last 10 years, we'd be way ahead.
Okay, but during the period, but I'm saying like per year.
So that's a starting point, but then it goes a lot further.
Okay.
So that's a very Keynesian starting point. So the first thing we're saying is, but Keynes said the budget has to be balanced across the cycle. Not true. Okay, but other than that, the whole idea of effective demand and everything, yes, the whole idea of functional finance, yes. That is the starting point. That is, you know, let's say step one, yes. But now we can go a lot further than that.
Okay, because I was going to ask you if you agreed with that, then how is that different from what Paul Krugman thinks, even though he doesn't think he is an MMT-er.
Yeah, it's not. But, you know, he draws his charts and graphs and shows how if you the deficit gets too high, you're going to hit hyperinflation someday. And, you know, I disagree with what he's the assumptions behind those charts and graphs he's got. And I had that conversation with him personally. And mm-hmm. in private, he concedes I'm correct. In public, he doesn't. So, you know, that's another story.
I might want to do a whole episode just on that. But OK, yeah, yeah. So over, like I say, over a decades long time frame, though, to me, it sounds like at most you're saying, yes, in those periods where the old school mentality, the outdated obsolete view would allow for persistence of high unemployment and factories running at half capacity.
Yeah.
But in general,
well, right, yeah, that's, most, it's not just okay. those periods. It's most of the time, right?
Well, why?
Capacity utilization is way below historical levels now.
Okay.
You know, and if you look at our percentage of the labor force working, it's way down. And, you know, what's the risk in testing it to see if it can be run at much higher levels? Well, there's two risks. You know, one risk is what I would say is you might start seeing some kind of inflation from excess demand. And we'd all agree with that. But the additional risk that everybody else is worried about is that we're going to turn into Greece. And that risk we don't have to worry about. And so what I'm saying, and so I think we're agreeing on that, that we don't have to worry about the finance side. We do have to worry about the inflation side. But if that's all we were worrying about, I contend that right now we'd be the trade-offs for running hotter right now are it's enormously to our benefit to run a little bit hotter right now than colder.
Okay, so you did answer my question.
But that's arguable.
Okay, so
but, you know, there's two things that say no. One is that we might get inflation. The second is look at our finances are going to fall apart. We're going to, you know, it's going to break down. So once we get rid of all those people arguing that the deficit's too high, we can't do it, and we get them arguing only about whether we're going to have some kind of inflation from excess demand, you know, then we've won half the battle.
Okay.
But there's more. I'm not stopping here. This is just a stopping point. It's not the end.
Okay. So, what I'm trying to get to is when somebody says something like, oh yeah, these proposals, you know, more military defense, Martian moon base, maybe Medicare for all, they sound great in theory. It's just too expensive. And you want to point out, well, no, there's no constraint on issuing bonds or just printing money, printing dollars. And then what if they fall back and say, well, no, I'm talking about ultimately, you know, that's just shorthand. I mean, there's a real resource constraint. There's scarcity. There's a production possibilities frontier. Your view is now over the next 30 years, if we don't change our policies, we're going to be well within that production possibilities frontier. So there really is no trade. There's no trade-off in that sense that we can have, you think under your proposal, output could be higher virtually every year compared to the counterfactual. Is that right?
Yeah, when I get finished with all my proposals, I'm going to be looking at output that could be more than 10% higher.
Perpetually.
I mean, it's a lot. It's not one or two.
Okay.
There's some one-time things that'll give us 10%, but the continuing, you know, once we've caught up, it would be certainly 1-3% higher than what we're doing now, if not 5.
Okay, and then again, just to beat a dead horse here, but what's driving that is that because you think right now there really is just an incredibly low... There's a lot of slack in the system.
Yes.
There's a lot of unused resources. And so that's where we're, quote, paying for this in a real resource sense, as you think right now, the status quo, there's lots of unused potential.
Yeah, and there's ways to – right now we can't tap that potential without – you know, there are ways to tap that potential without triggering inflation, you know, that are superior to what we have today.
Okay. All right.
And I can give you one example.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, so right now we have what we call the Phillips curve where we watch unemployment and we watch various measures of it. And what we run into is, particularly in Europe now, where you have the Nehru at, 10% or something where they think it is, employers don't like to hire people who aren't working. They just don't like to do that. And there are studies that show that. They'd rather hire somebody already working who has some kind of a employment history. So you can go to their boss or their supervisor and get, say, and find out whether this person has good work habits and things like that. If they're just unemployed in the streets and they've been unemployed and they're at home and they haven't been working, you don't know. It's high risk. They might be on drugs. They might not take a bath every day. They might get in fights with their employees. Businesses don't want to hire those people. Mm-hmm. Right? So the idea is how do we transition them from unemployed, where they're in the public sector because, you know, taxes function to create unemployment. We get into this later. Tax liabilities have function to pull people out of the private sector into the public sector so the government can then hire them with its currency. How do we get those people that the government doesn't want to hire and we don't want to just load up the public sector? How do we get them back into the private sector? How do they transition back? And one very, very effective way to do that is to give them what I call transition jobs, what the MMT proponents call the job guarantee. By offering a transition job, let me call it that, rather than the job guarantee, at some, and I call it a non-disruptive wage, and we can argue whether that's $10 an hour or 15, but it's just a numeraire. It doesn't matter in theory. And having these people come into this job makes them now a whole lot more employable, and they will then transition into the private sector. We can then use fiscal expansion, you know, lower taxes or higher public spending. Well, let's start with lower taxes to create more aggregate demand so that companies will, sales will go up and they'll start hiring these people out of the transition job where you can't get a raise in pay into the private sector. And they'll pay more than the transition job. There'll be a spread. And that will transition these people out of the public sector into the private sector. Now, the problem I see with these MMT proponents is they say they want a job guarantee. Everybody's going to guarantee the job. We're going to get 30 million people. And the first question is, well, what are they all going to do? And when they start explaining the types of jobs they're going to do, wrong answer, okay? What they're going to do is transition into the private sector over some period of time, 6 months, a year, 2 years, okay? And that's the whole point of getting them into this job guarantee is to transition them into the private sector. It's not about what they're going to do, although that's fine. I'm not arguing against that, and I'm not going to say there aren't useful things they can do. But that's not the logic driving the monetary system, the monetary side of the equation. The monetary logic is that we unemployed these people through our taxation. We then didn't hire them. The government then has responsibility to put them back where they took them from. You know, we've damaged them by making them unemployed. The private sector doesn't want them back because they're unemployed. We give them transition jobs and they transition back into the private sector. And this has been demonstrated over and over again. And historically, we have Argentina, we have India, places where this is happening and has happened. And it's all documented that this is true. And there have been a lot of private sector studies showing that this is how things work. And we have nothing to lose by trying it. Okay, there's no downside to doing this. But what it means is that employed people, transition people in a transition job are a lot more liquid than unemployed when it comes to transitioning from unemployment to the private sector. And so you don't get bottlenecks and employment shortages and labor shortages when you still have a lot of unemployed because they're much more available to be hired. It's like having a buffer stock of wool. That's how Bill Mitchell first got started with his buffer stock employment policy. The government can buy wool when the price is low, but when the price goes up, you have to be able to sell it back into the system for it to be stabilizing. Well, you got to keep the wool good. You got to keep it fresh. You got to keep it clean. You got to keep the, you know, otherwise it's useless. If you have a butter buffer stock, you got to keep it cold and fresh or it's useless. Okay, so any buffer stock the government runs, if you have grain buffer stock, you got to keep it in ready to eat condition or it's worthless. So if you've got a labor buffer stock, you've got to keep it in a ready to hire condition to provide the liquidity to allow non-inflationary expansion. So you might be able to have a labor buffer stock that's 1 or 2% of the population or 3% versus having 4, 5, or 6% unemployed for price stability. And so you're able to run the economy 2 or 3% hotter than you would otherwise to increase private sector output, employment, and growth.
Okay, well, let me just ask then exactly how this, I guess I'm failing to see the logic. So the right now the idea is if there's high unemployment, private companies are afraid to hire those workers because it's a bad signal. Like if somebody's unemployed, you know, they could have drug problems or who knows what, but they would be, they would be willing to hire someone who's working for the government.
So if you're, if you're in an insurance company and you want to hire somebody in your cafeteria, you'll hire somebody working for McDonald's. You're making $12 an hour. You offer them $15 and you're done. Instead of trying to hire somebody who's unemployed.
So if that's the case, why would I, if the government's not exercising any kind of screening policy, how does that, if I'm an employer, why would I trust someone who's been working for the government for 3 months versus someone who's unemployed?
Okay, you have an employment record. They're coming in every day. You've got a supervisor you can talk to. Okay, you know they're probably not on drugs, and you know they're not getting in fights. You can, you know, just the idea that they're getting up and they're coming in and they're going to work every day is a big plus. Now, we actually did this in Argentina. Daniel Kosar was with the labor ministry down there. He had read my paper. It's called Full Employment and Price Stability. It came out in 1997, published in some Keynesian Journal of Economics or something, post-Keynesian Journal, whatever. But he went up to UMKC, studied it. And then in 2001, when Argentina collapsed with 32 dead in the street, the currency blew up. They went off the peg, floated the peso. They immediately started this Jefes program where they offered jobs to any head of household who wanted a job, and it paid like nothing. It was like 100 pesos a month or something, but that was like nothing. But they got something like 2 million people out of a population of 33 or 4 million or 5 million into this program. And they did little regional infrastructure programs like digging sewer trenches, and they ran daycare centers for kids with, gave them lunches or something. And you know, it cost the government very little. And these people were all, had never worked in the private sector, and they were all presumed to not even be employable. They were like Indians and disadvantaged. And within 2 years, 1 million of them transitioned into private sector jobs. They were hired by, you know, into regular private sector jobs. And they, we went down there, and people like Pavlina interviewed them, Chernova, Professor Chernova. This was back in 2002 and three. We asked them, would you rather come in and do this work or just stay home and get the 100 pesos a month? And like every one of them said they wanted to come in and work. It was pretty interesting. And it was enormously successful. They had the best economy in the world for, I don't know, 3 years or something like that. And I know it was coming from a very low level. I'm not trying to give this full credit, but it certainly added a million people to their labor force, which, as you know, is a source of real wealth, right? Without that, you don't get any. That's what GDP is all about. And all fully documented. So, and India has done the same thing with the rural poor program. They've had something like 60 million people in that program who nobody ever expects them to get jobs, and they wind up transitioning into the private sector all over the place. So, those are just two examples.
Right. So let me, push you a little bit on that. So it's, and this is something too, and you actually alluded to it a minute ago where you said, if it's really not a jobs guarantee, is that if it really were a job guarantee, then they couldn't fire you, in which case if you showed up drunk or were chronically late.
Yeah.
So you're saying it's really just a government employment program that does have standards though, and they can lay you off or fire you. And when somebody says, well, gee, if it makes economic sense, then how come some private company isn't hiring them? And because in terms of its own revenues and expenses, it actually is not self-sufficient. Like whatever these, like the daycare services, parents wouldn't pay enough for a private company to hire the people to do that. But you, so it's implicitly being subsidized by the government, but you're saying it's worth it socially.
Yeah. The private company, let's look at Argentina. You know, they had 2 million people go into this and 1 million went into the private sector. Mm-hmm. Private sector doesn't want to hire 2 million people and then eventually send 1 million home. Okay. They can't do that. But the government's already got them. They're already unemployed. They're already in the public sector. This is how they can transition half of them out to the private sector. The private sector is just not going to do that. That's not what people do. It's not how you increase shareholder value. And so what we get is bottlenecks and labor costs going up towards the end of our cycles, you know, and it's all called Phillips curve and Nehru and everything else. When if it was an employed buffer stock, which is a whole lot more liquid, that would happen. That wouldn't happen until that number got a whole lot lower and the private sector was running a whole lot hotter. So that's a proposal that you would only do if you understood modern monetary theory or if you understood how the monetary operations worked. Now, I'm not saying you should buy this or not, but I'm saying we couldn't even be discussing this if we were going to say, yeah, but it's going to cost $77 billion and we're going to turn into Greece. There's no discussion at that point. Okay, it's not, you can't discuss it with the European Central Bank or with Italy. Because they will turn into Greece because they don't have that ability to do that. The central bank will not allow them to do that. Okay, you could discuss it with the European Central Bank, but not with Italy.
Yeah, just for the benefit of our listeners who are losing, you're saying because the countries that are under the euro, they don't have independent monetary authority the way like the U.S. government or Venezuelan's government did.
Yeah, you couldn't discuss it with California. California can't go do this or Massachusetts. Right. People have tried. Oh, let's try it at the state level. Don't even bother to discuss it. It's just an expense that's going to blow out there if they're going to turn into Greece. Okay, it's got to be done at the federal level. The scorekeeper has to do this, not the players in the card game. It's a whole different thing.
Okay, and so then what would you say? So it sounds like Venezuela was doing okay in the early 2000s, and then obviously at some point something went wrong. Sorry for the interruption, folks. This is Bob Murphy talking to you after this interview transpired. Upon review, before we release this to you guys, I realized I just goofed right there. Warren had been talking about Argentina, and somehow I thought he was saying Venezuela. And so don't be confused. The unemployment transition project that Warren Mosler is talking about here, they implemented in Argentina. And so I should have said, and I could have said, because it also was applicable to Argentina, well, couldn't a critic say that it worked well in the beginning, but it's not like Argentina's doing very good economically right now. And by the way, in case you don't know, that's a very fair question to ask. Their inflation rate was almost 50% last year, something like that. And they're in the midst of an economic crisis. Okay, not as bad as Venezuela, of course, but still nothing to brag about. But I just wanted to not confuse people. So I'm chiming in here to say I goofed. I should have been asking Warren about Argentina, not Venezuela. Okay, and now we return to our regularly scheduled interview. So a cynic would say, yeah, you know, this shows what happens, the end game of your results, Mosler. And I'm guessing you would disagree with that characterization.
Well, look, at Turkey's debt to GDP is only 35%. We have 25% inflation, right? So there's something else going on there. It's got nothing to do with this. You can't just look at someplace and say, oh, it's because people understand the monetary system, which is another interesting thing, Bob. Let's say once people understood the monetary system, you're afraid that bad things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Once they see what's behind the curtain,
right,
bad things are going to be happening. What be happening? So what you're telling me is, what I say is, look, either you believe in an informed electorate or you don't. And you're saying, look, I don't believe that people should be informed as to how things work because they're going to make bad decisions. You know, if people are free to buy whatever they want in a grocery store, they're going to buy bad food and they're going to all have diabetes and they're all going to die young and we're going to have massive medical expense. Well, interesting point, but I happen to think that public purpose is promoted by an informed electorate. And I might be wrong. I'll give you that right off the bat. And if I am, and that's why you disagree with it, fine, I respect that. But that's a different question. So if we start with the premise that an informed electorate serves public purpose and take it from there, we have one discussion. If we decide that an informed electorate is a terrible thing and we should keep people in the dark, okay, we have a different discussion going.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm glad you said that because it ties into another, I guess, objection or consideration is,
yeah,
suppose somebody says, okay, you know, let's say the government, there's some funding proposal on the, you know, like jobs guarantee or, you know, some appropriately titled thing. Yeah. And it would involve a subsidy of whatever, $1 billion a year.
Yeah.
And we could raise taxes and, you know, have a slight increase in the sales or whatever, the income tax to pay for it. The public wouldn't go for it. And so, but hey, why don't we just run the printing press instead? So what if somebody objects and says, the fact that you couldn't pay for it with a tax hike means the public doesn't think it's worth it. And the only reason they're okay if you do it with the printing press is because they really don't fully get how they're still, quote, paying for it in real terms.
Okay, well, that's, you know, we haven't lost that. Okay, what we have is the idea, the way I say it, and it's not, it's just a way to say it, is that taxes in general are more powerful than spending. And the reason I say that is we can have $3.5 trillion of taxes right now, which allows $4.5 trillion of spending right now without inflation, because there's some kind of desire to save that last $1 trillion in the economy. Okay, that $1 trillion deficit we're running now under Trump, what is it? Okay, what is the public debt? It's the dollars spent that haven't yet been used to pay taxes. So the government's going to spend $4.5 trillion. $3.5 trillion gets used to pay taxes, and the other trillion doesn't. It's been credited to somebody's account. You can say printed, but all money is printed. There's no, it's just scorekeeping. It's been credited to somebody's account, and it's first in their reserve account, and then they decided they want to earn a little interest, the bank, whoever has it, and they you know, take those funds and buy treasury securities, which are just the same dollars in a securities account at the same Federal Reserve Bank. So the $1 trillion gets credited to reserve accounts, and then the Fed debits the reserve accounts and credits the securities accounts. And the trillion in those securities accounts held by somebody in the securities, that's the public debt. And it wouldn't be there if those people didn't want it, because the federal government has spent the $4.5 trillion there have been willing sellers who are willing to sell things, goods and services at today's prices to get the $1 trillion to stick in their securities account. So for whatever reason, they may be complete idiots. You know, I'm not disagreeing with that, you know, but they're doing it. The dollars are tax credits. They're willing to keep these tax credits for later, to save them for later. That's what the numbers are telling us right now. So right now, it only takes $3.5 trillion to support $4.5 trillion of funding. Well, we don't know what the limit to that is. Maybe it takes $5 trillion. Maybe there's room for another $0.5 trillion before we're at full capacity. If we have an employed buffer stock instead of an unemployed, maybe it's $5.5 trillion. Maybe there's a desire for $2 trillion in savings. I don't know. But when we get to that limit, there will be a size of the deficit where then if we want to increase, we're going to have to increase taxes. So that effect you're talking about is there. It's always going to be there. It isn't going away. We're just running with excess capacity instead of full capacity. And so you want to make that decision when you're at full capacity. Otherwise, right now, we should be lowering taxes, not expanding them. And when you understand the monetary system right now, you have an MMT understanding. Right now, if somebody says, look, there's room to increase public services by $0.5 trillion to give free education to everybody and pay off all the debts or something. You say, okay, but that means there's also room to cut taxes by $0.5 trillion. And I'd rather do that. Perfectly logical thing to say. You know, you have a different sense of what serves public purpose, but you're not wrong. You're not monetarily wrong. So the answer to somebody who says, look, we can spend $1 trillion without causing inflation is, well, if you're a conservative and don't think the money should be spent there, you think there's moral hazard or it's wrong to do that, you can say, okay, well, then you're telling me there's room for another trillion tax cut, and I'd rather do that.
Okay, let me ask you this.
Trump $1 trillion tax cut did not cause inflation or the economy to overheat. So there was obviously room for it.
Okay, let me try this. Would you be okay with, would it simplify things or mess things up, or is there some problem? Couldn't they just say, you know what? It confuses people. Let's just get rid of federal debt altogether and just say every year the government's going to spend what it's going to spend. And if it wants to spend more than it takes it in tax revenue, it just prints up $100 bills. And that would be just much more honest accounting. That would, you know, wake everybody up to realize this is different from how your corporation or household works.
Yeah.
And then if prices start rising, everybody would know, oh, it's because they printed too much money. Yeah. Would you be okay with that?
Yeah. Not only am I okay with it, but that's functionally identical to one of my prime proposals, that we have a permanent 0% rate policy and the government stops selling securities. So now the government, you know, it debits your account for $3.5 trillion of taxes. It has $3.5 trillion of tax liabilities. It spends that $3.5 trillion, fine. But now people want to sell more things. They want to save. It spends another trillion. It goes into these securities reserve accounts. And you don't earn any interest on it, which is what you're talking about. Whether it's a $100 bill or a bank account that doesn't earn interest, it's the same thing. And yeah, and that's what it is. So that what you're describing is what we have today with a permanent zero rate policy, kind of like Japan's had for 30 years and Europe's had for the last 7 or 8 years. Okay, and that's prime. Yes, we should do that. I entirely agree with you. There's no reason for the state to pay interest on any of this excess spending. It should just have a permanent zero policy.
Okay. And then the last topic I still have you here just to tie in. So can you then explain, I think it's your number three.
Yeah.
Innocent fraud. You say government budget deficits take away savings.
Yeah.
And you actually want to say, no, it's the opposite. So can you tell the listeners, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Okay. And that's nominal savings, monetary savings. Mm-hmm. Real savings is when you grow food and you eat some and you save some for seeds for next year, or you save some to eat for next year. That's your real savings. Okay. And so we have the real versus the nominal. And so what happens is when the government spends more than it taxes, it subtracts $3.5 trillion from everybody's account, and then it adds $4.5 trillion. Well, now there's an extra trillion in everybody's account. Okay. So in that sense, it's added $1 trillion. Now, has it added any real savings? Is there real investment there necessarily? No. But there are tax credits. Nominal means dollars, which are tax credits. But when you say it increases your savings, it increases the savings of nominal tax credits. That's what it means. It doesn't take away. Okay, now, you and I can agree to that it's just nominal, it's not real. But there are people out there who say, and people in Congress don't understand the difference. And then you see these things about how deficits take away savings based on an accounting system that's a throwback to the gold standard, where if the government has outstanding liabilities like tax credits, there's an implication it has to give you that much gold. And so gold is part of our national treasure, and that's a debit on our gold supply. And so therefore, national savings has gone down. And they're absolutely correct under a fixed exchange rate or a gold standard. But with today's floating exchange rate policy, that kind of accounting is entirely inapplicable. It's not wrong, it just doesn't apply. And it's highly misleading if you start using that kind of language. So yes, deficit spending adds that many tax credits to the economy. Those tax credits are called dollars. Those dollars are nominal savings to the penny.
Okay, and so that's
arithmetic. There's no dispute for that.
Okay, and so that's why I kind of like seeing if you thought it was equivalent functionally to getting rid of the treasury. Because again, with government debt claims, I think people get confused.
Yeah.
But so really all your number three claim is saying is, or it's equivalent to saying, the government in 1 year, it taxes $1 trillion out of the private sector and it spends $1.5 trillion. And so, and if it finances that gap by literally printing up $100 bills,
yeah.
Well, when the dust settles, that means the private sector is holding $500 billion more
yes.
in U.S. dollars.
Right.
And so therefore, private sector wealth nominally has gone up by $500 billion.
That's right.
That's the extent of what you're saying.
Exactly. That's just, accounting arithmetic.
Okay.
And, there are people who would say that doing exactly what you said has taken $500 billion away from our savings, because under exactly what you said, the old definition of national savings, which people still use, would say national savings went down by that 100 because it's a liability, they're tax credits. And so the government owes that money, they owes people the ability to pay taxes. And so therefore national savings went down. That's what the Wharton guy going around talking about how broke we are, forget his name. That's what they all say.
Yeah, and this is what they call crowding out and stuff like that. That's the government runs a deficit.
I'm not saying you were saying this, but this is what I'm saying is the rhetoric that's been causing problems. That's why they're deadly innocent frauds. They're using the definition of national savings from fixed exchange rates to strike fear into people from over this operation that actually adds nominal savings.
Okay, and like I'm going to have explained this in the prelude when I introduce you to the listeners, but my point here is not to debate you. I just want to make sure we get your worldview. Just along those lines, then, can you share what about something like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies? Could I say for every Bitcoin mined, global wealth has gone up nominally by one Bitcoin? Is that a true statement?
If you want to define, you could define. A Bitcoin is a certificate, it's virtual, but it's a certificate you get for doing a puzzle. You get awarded this certificate that says you solved this puzzle. And you could say this certificate is wealth. So if you, earn a PhD and you get a certificate that says you've earned a PhD, you could say, okay, that's PhDs. We're going to define them as wealth because you did something to earn it. It's an investment that's going to serve you in the future or something. So if you want to define it as wealth, that's fine. So you can have a house full of stuff and you could call it all wealth, and you could define it in terms of how much you could get if you sold it in terms of dollars that day. It's all kinds of things you could do with it. So in that sense, it's nominal wealth. Yeah.
Okay. And then what about, couldn't I use accounting identities and prove that if General Motors on net issues bonds, then Planet Earth minus General Motors has had net savings to the extent of that bond issue. Is that also true by the accounting?
You don't have net because it's a dis savings for General Motors and a savings for whoever they gave the money to. So in the private sector, credit nets to zero. It's only when you, if you and I are in a room, we each have $10 in our pocket. We're never going to have more than $20 in that room unless we get it from the outside. So you can't change. We can go back and forth and I can give you and borrow 100 from you. And I can be plus 100 and you can be minus 100, but it's going to net $20 no matter what we do. And so that's what the sector analysis is all about. And so the government is outside of the private sector, outside of the economy for purposes of analysis. And so when the government spends $4 trillion and only taxes $3 trillion, that sector that got the trillion now has that extra money has flowed in, so to speak, has been credited to their accounts. They've got those extra tax credits, that extra nominal wealth. But without that, can't happen. It's just, you know what they used to call inside money and outside money?
Mm-hmm.
It's all inside money. So it's like the Federal Reserve is just inside money. Banks can't change the amount of dollars in the total dollars in the reserve accounts. Only the scorekeeper can do that. Only the Fed can do that. They can only shift them back and forth to each other. So you can't get any net financial assets in the economy without them coming from the government.
Well, okay, but hang on.
Assuming there's two sectors, the government sector and then everybody else.
Okay, but a minute ago, Bitcoin worked and they're not the government. And so they're the reason.
They're not denominated in dollars.
Okay.
Bitcoins are denominated in Bitcoins.
Okay. And then just though, to be clear with the GM thing though, I said, couldn't the world minus GM go up in net assets? So I agree. Planet Earth doesn't.
Yeah. GM goes down. Everybody else goes up. Yeah.
Okay. And so so the issue is if it's a thing that can, without constraint, issue. So just like the Bitcoin protocol can create Bitcoins without them being subtracted from somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the US government. So so the issue is Planet Earth, you can have some groups going up and the other ones going down. It's just a debit and credit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that the US has no constraint on how many dollars they can issue, whereas GM, you know, they can't print money. That's the difference.
Well, you know, they can issue bonds in return for dollars to the extent that they can find a counterparty. But see, they have to like get the dollars first before they can spend them. For the government, it's the opposite, as we had in fraud number one. They have to spend first before they can collect taxes or sell bonds. It's the opposite. It's like the football stadium. They don't collect the tickets first and then sell them. They sell the ticket first and then collect it. But the rest of us have to get the ticket first before we can use it.
Right. And you're saying there because you can't pay taxes, it couldn't be on day zero the government collects taxes and then spends the money because nobody would have dollars from the beginning.
Right. It's like frequent flyer miles. You know, you got to get award them first before they can collect them.
Right. Okay.
If you got the water monopoly and you got all the water, people can't drink the water first and then go get it.
Right. Okay. Well, your time is not something that was without constraint. So we'll wrap up here, Warren.
Okay.
Thank you for your time in doing this. So as far as pointing people, obviously I'll point them to your website. And is the main thing just the 7 deadly innocent frauds, or are there other things?
Yeah, I'd say once there, but I've got a lot of other things, policy options that open up that you can take or leave, but they are options that weren't there before. And right now, my issue is, we're not considering a lot of policy options because we don't understand the monetary system. Now, once we consider them, we might not like them. But there are other policy options that right now are beyond consideration because of our politicians and whatever support they're getting from the media and from economists, who I'll say are innocent to the truth, are not even considering these options. And I believe that in an informed electorate. And so here we are, and I hope this has been helpful.
Yeah, I think it has. It certainly has clarified my understanding of MMT, and I think that of the listeners too. So, Warren Mosler, thanks for your time, and maybe we'll be in touch down the road.
Good talk to you. Thanks very much.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.